Welcome to the ISF podcast from the Information Security Forum, featuring timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm your host, Tavia Gilbert. Today, ISF CEO Steve Durbin is in conversation with Mark Rawls, President and COO of Invicti Security, a Texas-based company that provides dynamic web application security solutions. You'll hear Mark mention what he calls the FUD approach to security, playing up fear, uncertainty, and doubt. Steve and Mark talk about the cost this ultimately can have in relation to people, process, technology, and outsourcing. They also discuss the current threat landscape, security by design, and developing the next generation of cybersecurity talent.
So, Mark, great to have you with us on the podcast. Thank you very much indeed for joining me today.
Oh, you're very welcome, Steve. I'm happy to be here, and thanks for having me on.
I wanted to talk to you specifically about, because here we are, you know, just at the start of the year now. I wanted to talk to you to get your perspective, both in terms of 2021, but also 2022 on the security landscape. What is going on? I mean, you're in amongst it in your organization. Give our listeners some of that insight that you've gathered as to where we're headed.
Of course. Yeah. Thank you, Steve. It's kind of like the more things change, the more they stay the same. And so as we look at the security landscape and we look at the threats that are out there, and then we also look at the status of the defenses, it really is somewhat, we can keep continuing and we keep running into the same challenges year in and year out. And so whether you have this conversation at the start of 22 or the start of 2012 or the start of 2002, as far as you go back, you know, at the end of the day, the number of attacks continues to increase. The sophistication and number of different attack vectors continues to grow. And yet organizations are not keeping up in terms of the investments that they make into cybersecurity. They aren't keeping up in terms of the size of the teams. And so you have this condition that arguably is as difficult now as it ever has been, where the defenders are really getting exhausted. You've got the last now coming up on 2 years dealing with COVID, dealing with the shift to remote work, and then dealing with the fallout of SolarWinds, the fallout of Colonial Pipeline, the continued events and attacks that occur. You really have cybersecurity professionals that are exhausted, and yet the attackers just continue to come. And so in this environment, it's ever more important that we continue to focus on hiring, training, and development of cybersecurity resources, that we have the right tooling for them, that we give them the right resources, and that those resources continue and those tools continue to get more sophisticated, because we have to, because the attackers are continuing to get more sophisticated. And if we don't match them where they are, then we're going to continue to be overrun, which is really what's been happening. Again, whether you are sitting here in 2022, or you're sitting in 2012, or you're sitting in 2002, I think if we go to 92, we're probably safe. If you go back to war games, we can just play tic-tac-toe, it'll be fine. Right. But certainly for the last 20 years, it's been largely the same kind of song and dance year in, year out. And I would love to come here and say that, hey, look, this is the year we're finally going to get ahead. But I don't know that that's true, right? I think we've got to continue to focus. We've got to see Biden last year had some great moves in terms of the executive orders and the focus there, but we've really got to see those things bear out. And we have to see the continued attention and focus that it's going to take really to change the game that we're playing here.
I think that's absolutely right. I think you make some really valid points there. And I wanted to go into one or two of them in a bit more detail. You know, you make the point that we do have skill shortage. We've been talking about that now since it seems like forever. And I'm not convinced that we're making much headway in that space. It's probably unfair to ask you if there's a silver bullet. I don't think there is. But what are some of the things that people listening to this could actually do? You know, everybody is short of resource, right? Mm-hmm. What are some really practical steps you think that they could take to address that one, first of all?
Yeah, this is something that we talk a lot about within Invicti, because we have our own teams to staff, whether that's our engineering team, our professional services teams, our customer support teams, et cetera. You know, so we deal with the shortage in the same way that any company really does. And what we focus a lot on is how do we build and train up our resources? And, you know, there's a classic joke that goes around on, I've seen it on LinkedIn and other places, where it's a conversation hypothetically between a CEO and a CFO, where the CFO is saying, well, what if we spend all this time and money training our resources and then they leave? To which the CEO, you know, in this joke responds, well, what if we don't do that and they stay? Right. So you really have to lean in on training people up. And that may mean that you lose some folks, right? And that's the way it is. And on some level, I think it's maybe something we have to do for the greater good. But one of the things that we think a lot about is how do we hire and bring in a core of really talented, really experienced people. But I know, and I think this is the same situation everyone deals with, we don't have the budget or the ability to staff a full-size team. It's all really strong, experienced professionals that have been in cybersecurity and really know the ins and outs and maybe have 10 or 15 or 20 years experience. And so what we've done very consciously and very purposely, and I think this is something that every company can replicate, is, you know, we do hire as many of those folks as we can, but that may be 10% or 20% of a given team. And then we complement that with very energetic, bright, but junior folks that we can bring in and really train up. And so we've invested a lot in our learning management system, in our training, in our employee onboarding, and really teaching those employees what they need to know and pairing them with these senior resources and these senior people who've been around and have seen the industry evolve. They've seen different threats, because at the end of the day, that's really our only way out of this from a people perspective. Now, we can talk about tools, automation, AI, some of your favorite topics in a little bit, but I think just starting out and looking at the people, we've got to invest in the next generation. And the fact is that universities, other education programs, they're not going to keep up with the very tactical skills and the very cutting edge skills that our employees need in order to fight, again, these emerging threats. We have to do that. And it may mean that we train someone up and we get 12 to 18 to 24 months and they might get an offer to go elsewhere. And you know what? That's great. It's great for us. It's great for the industry. It's great for overall security. But we've just got to keep going, and we've got to keep bringing those people in and hiring and training them and really kind of getting them up that learning curve. Because again, I truly believe that's the only way that as an industry, we're going to get out of this. And the good news is there are more and more companies out there, the Pluralsights, Cloud Gurus, others of the world, where you don't have to create your own training quite as much, right? You can bring in training from outside. You can purchase content or modules or whatnot, again, to help your employees get up to speed. But I think that's truly our only way out of this. You can't get away with no experienced people in the room, but yet none of us, I think, have the budget to have a room filled with only experienced people. Again, you've got to find that balance. And that's going to be different for every company and every geography and different roles and focus areas. But it really doesn't matter how big you are or how big your budget is. No one can staff up fully. So we've got to hire, we've got to train. And I truly believe that's our only way out of this. And one final anecdote on this point for you. We had a customer advisory board meeting late last year, and we had a, you know, cybersecurity leader, kind of a VP level person from a very large US firm. And he said that he had one cybersecurity person per 500 engineers. And I said, that's crazy. Like, why, you know, why that ratio? Is that a budget problem? Do you need help, you know, proving the ROI? And he said, no, it's not a budget problem at all. It's strictly and purely a talent acquisition problem. There just aren't enough professionals out there. And again, I think that's where we've got to shift the focus and say, there are never going to be enough talented folks out there unless we start training them ourselves.
That's a great perspective. I mean, for a long while now, I've been talking about the need for security to just expand its outlook, if you like. To your point, you know, we're never going to have enough expertise. We're never going to have enough of these people who we could just put in front of a screen or walk into the job tomorrow and are going to be up and running. And so we do have to get much more, I think, imaginative about where we go and find these resources. And I don't know whether you saw this, but a few days ago now, I did see, because I'm a big fan on apprentice schemes and that kind of thing. And I did see, again, on LinkedIn, one of these very large US organizations that had hired an apprentice who was 60 years of age. Who is a veteran.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, fantastic. Yeah. You know, because what you're doing there, you talked about 18-month, 24-month turnaround in people. Mm-hmm. Well, they're taking somebody who is obviously highly skilled in his own area, has a number of attributes that can be cross-referenced into the space he's going into. And why should we confine apprenticeship programs to those that are of a much younger age? So I think, you know, that starting to see some of those things, for me anyway, shows me that we are starting to think a little bit more broadly about the issue. These, for me, are little green shoots that are starting to appear. You mentioned another really interesting topic and subject which people talk to me a lot about, which is budget. You know, I don't have the money. How do I get the return on investment? How do I justify to my board? Any tips on that for people listening in?
That's a great question. And it's something that we hear quite a bit. And as a software provider, we are often in position of trying to help our internal champions and advocates, again, get the budget for our tool, which we believe to be very high ROI. And we're very proficient about making that point. But if we talk about, you know, headcount or really any kind of tool, I think a lot of the trends that we're seeing is that this is actually an area that boards are getting much more interested in, much more focused. And so while we need to keep helping our customers and we as an industry need to do a better job of speaking to the ROI, I think there's a trend that actually the boards are going to start helping us out. But let's set that aside for a moment. I think there's two basic approaches here that you can really take. And, you know, I think there's always a tendency to go for the first approach that I'll talk about, but I'm just not sure that it's the right one. And that's what we all call the FUD approach, right? Fear, uncertainty, yep. doubt. And that's the, oh my gosh, there's this huge long tail risk. If we are breached, that could be hundreds of millions of dollars. Like, oh my gosh, think of the career limiting factors or show them testimony of the Equifax leadership in front of Congress, the SolarWinds leadership in front of Congress, FireEye leadership in front of Congress. Like, there is definitely a path there. And I think boards do understand that. And a lot of the focus of someone on a board of directors is around reducing that risk. And so I think there's a place for it. But I think anyone that makes that their first and primary cause, I think is kind of setting themselves up for a difficult day in, day out challenge. Because at the end of the day, it's a remote risk. And if you've read any kind of behavioral finance or behavioral economics, you know that the human brain weighs those risks, you know, does kind of a very poor job of weighing those risks
right.
versus things that are much more proximate. And what we're starting to see is that when you have a fully staffed security team and you can identify security vulnerabilities, you can identify risk much earlier and faster within your overall development process, then you can also remediate those much faster and much easier. And I think this is an area that boards are actually, at the end of the day, much more open and amenable to. When you can show them things like, look, if we have a properly staffed security team, we can find vulnerabilities much faster. We can find them before they've been released. Ideally, we're finding them within days of when they're created. Well, then that allows that developer to remediate much faster. It reduces the number of developer hours required around security. It speeds our time to a secure release. And I think that's a language that boards also understand. And that's a very tangible near-term benefit that you see, as opposed to, hey, we're going to avoid this very scary, but very unlikely scenario. It's, hey, every day that we do this, we get more efficient, we get more effective, and ultimately we're going to save cost. And as our organization continues to grow, we're going to require fewer developers because they're going to spend less of their time trying to track down and remediate a security vulnerability. Because like anyone, and I think everyone can relate to this, if you ask me to fix something that I did yesterday, obviously I can do that much faster than when you come back and ask me to fix something I did 2 months ago.
Right.
Right. A lot can happen between then. And so it's not that one approach is right and one approach is wrong. It's that you need them both. And you've got to balance how much you speak to each one. And obviously you can put big numbers up with the FUD approach, but if you can get to some numbers on the developer efficiency, the time to remediation, and you can show those benefits, that's a very tangible and very immediate feedback loop that I think most boards, most executive teams can really get behind.
I think you're right. And that sort of leads me on to another area that I wanted to talk to you about. I mean, on this podcast series over the years, we've talked quite a lot about the concept of security by design, you know, trying to get mm-hmm. security built in right from the off. Really important, of course, when we're developing apps, when we're developing systems of any shape or form.
That's right.
Are we doing enough in that space, do you think, as a software development organization? You know, I'm interested in your take on that. You know, is security by design, building that in, the kind of thing that we've cracked? Is that one of the things we can tick in the box now? We're on the way. We can breathe a sigh of relief. Don't need to worry about that one. Let's move on to something else. Where are we?
Oh, I wish. I so wish. What a wonderful place that would be. That, you know what? I should have asked for that for Christmas. That would have been better than what I actually got. You know, the way we started this podcast, where we talked about how, in some sense, it's the same old challenges. But the fact is, we are better than we ever have been, right? And we're better than we ever have been in secure by design. But I think the reality is, and this is true not just in security, you know, I got my start in my career actually more on the analytics, business intelligence part of the organization. And, you know, fundamentally, we dealt with similar challenges there, which is you're always trying to solve the problem that's right in front of you. Mm-hmm. And it's a rare organization that has the kind of internal fortitude, or in some cases, just a cold business reality that you might want to take, you know, an extra month or 2 months or an extra quarter to develop this feature so that you are future-proofing it. And again, whether that's when I started my career, more of an analytics perspective, like we need to build our data warehouse in a way we can solve problems that we don't know exist yet. And what could those problems look like? We don't know what they are, but we might know some of the parameters around them. In the same way, being secure by design, we need to build this taking into account the different threat vectors that could arise, different potential risks to this application. And even an application that we may say, hey, this will never be publicly accessible, you don't know that as you build that application for the first time. Use cases can change. You know, something that starts as an internal tool can end up as an external facing product or service. And so if you make that investment up front, and again, it might mean doing an extra 25% more work or 50% more work, you know for a fact in virtually all cases, that is going to end up being one of the best investments you ever made from an ROI perspective in terms of the hours returned. Because if you are secure by design from the outset, there is so much remediation and so much other work that won't have to be done in the future. But it's just very hard for organizations to think that through. And again, this is not a security issue. I've seen this across companies. Right. And so I think it goes back to, again, like we talked about, it's one of those laws of human nature that people really struggle to do this and they really struggle to think about all of the potential ways in which this application could be used and therefore all of the security precautions we should take from the very beginning. And it also flies in the face to a certain degree of some of the basic philosophies of software development around being fast to ship, getting things in front of the customer quickly, pursuing minimum viable product. These things are going to slow your path to market, right? They're going to slow your pace of innovation at first, but then of course you're going to reap huge benefits down the road. It's just a very hard thing for organizations to do. And so while I think we're doing better than we ever have been, I think it's going to be an eternal struggle. And again, this is one of those areas that you almost chalk up more to human psychology and like life on the savannah, you know, tens of thousands of years ago, than the fact that organizations are incapable of doing the right thing. No, we're just not wired for it. But once you know that and you acknowledge that, well, then as an organization, you know, if you're a CISO listening to this or you're a CTO listening to this, how do you actually build a better process? How do you build stage gates and checkpoints and reviews to force this into your organization? Because left to its own devices, your organization will never do this. It's just a fact. If it were any other way, we wouldn't be, again, sitting here in 2022 still talking about, is this the year we finally get secured by design correct? Right. That's kind of where I come back on some of these things is they won't happen by themselves. So then how do you create an environment? How do you create a process that forces them to happen?
I think that's a great perspective. And I think that sort of philosophy that you're never going to get it right every single time, but how do you get close enough to what is acceptable to you and, you know, the risk appetite that your organization has and is the right way for organizations to be going. But let me ask you this. A lot of the trend that we're seeing at the moment, of course, is to outsourcing. Because to the points that we've just raised, you know, you don't have enough people, you don't have the skill set, so let's hand that off to somebody else, let's outsource. But that then introduces a whole pile of other issues into the mix, right? How, again, somebody listening to this who is thinking, well, I don't have the resource, I don't have the skill sets to go down the sort of route that Mark is talking about, but let me outsource it to a third party. What are the kinds of things that people should be looking for when they're looking for that outsourcing partner? What's the checklist they should be going through to make sure that they're selecting the right, whether it be apps developer or service provider?
That's a great question. And quite honestly, I mean, that's something that we still struggle with. And I've got outsource partners that I've worked with before that I love and that are great. And you'll have four successful projects, and then the fifth one will go off the rails. And you start to wonder, well, wait a minute, I know this is a great organization. And I think the reality is that the first thing you have to ask yourself is, aside from the logo and the reputation of the firm, what's the reputation of the people, right? Who are on your project or working on your engagement? Because at the end of the day, that's the team you're getting, you know, and it may be a different team, you know, each time. And so you really have to understand that. And I think you also have to look for an organization that has a very well-defined, very repeatable process, right? So this gets back to the same thing we talked about. It was secured by design. It's not just going to happen in of itself. Similarly, good project governance is never an accident. It's something that's really built in. And so when an organization can walk you through their process, their stage gates in a very clear way, in a very methodical way, you know, that's obviously a really good indicator that they are adept at getting to repeatable outcomes, which is ultimately what you're looking for. And that even if you have a newer team or perhaps a less experienced team, if they've been trained in that methodology, and if they're following that methodology, you can have a certain assurance as to their outcomes. And I think the other thing that you can never lose sight of is there's always this temptation to say, okay, well, this, we'll just outsource this and that will solve our bandwidth bottleneck. But the fact is that you have to have internal resources to manage that external team and to manage them very closely. You know, this goes back to that old adage, what gets measured gets done. If you aren't measuring them, if you aren't holding them accountable, if you aren't having those weekly steering committee meetings, those weekly status checks or check-ins, if you aren't holding them accountable to follow the process they've walked you through, that's the process they follow each time, it's only human nature, again, that they start perhaps taking shortcuts or they're not following everything, you know, to the letter the way they should. And so you've got to have that strong program manager or leader on your side that's really holding that vendor accountable to deliver the work the way they say that they will deliver it. And I think that's the other area that folks get themselves in trouble is they say, oh, well, we're outsourcing it. So therefore, our engineering manager doesn't need to focus on that because that's outsourced. It's like, no. Your engineering manager can't focus on the internal work because they're managing the outsourcer.
Right.
It's not a cure-all. And if you don't have that really strong internal management that's really driving that vendor, you're probably not going to be very happy with where you end up.
And for a number of organizations that certainly I speak to, you know, they have found that third-party vendor management particularly complex during the pandemic. Now, I would have hoped that by now we'd have been talking about having been freed from it and we'd be all going back to the way that we used to, we used to work. But it's all up and down, you know, wherever you happen to be in the world. As soon as somebody is opening up, somebody else is locking down. And unfortunately, that's going to be the way for a while yet. So any tips that you can give people for how to manage that remotely? Because again, you know, most of the time, of course, the best thing is just get people in a room, figure it out, do those checks, look at the different stage gates, as you say, that you've got to manage it through that way. We've got to do it remotely still in a large number of instances. How can we get better at doing that?
Again, back in the pre-COVID days, which a different lifetime ago, you know, if you were going to spin up a large external vendor, one of the first things you might do is, you know, send your program manager on site with them. Maybe this vendor is in Central Europe, maybe they're in India or another offshore location, or maybe they're just somewhere else, again, onshore. But you may embed your program manager with their team for a few weeks, or you may bring their leadership over and embed them into your team on site for a few weeks. There were different paths to take. But to your point, you had everyone in the same room, right? And at any given time, you can pull somebody into a meeting room and grab a whiteboard and start sketching out, you know, whatever challenge that you're facing. That obviously can't happen anymore. I think the thing that you have to be aware of in the current environment is that there's serendipitous kind of office run-ins, you know, at the proverbial water cooler, or the coffee machine. Those aren't happening anymore. They're not going to happen by chance. You have to schedule them. And that's going to feel forced. And in a lot of those, if you have a daily 15-minute check-in call, you know what? 4 out of 5 days, that's not going to be a very worthwhile use of time. But the fifth day, you may happen upon or discover somewhere in which you are not aligned, there isn't clarity, there's some issue or problem that's been bubbling up on the vendor side that you haven't been aware of, and that the vendor may see this as kind of a minor issue, but then upon discovery, you may explore it and discover, no, this is actually a major problem. And so you've really got to mandate those, and you've got to stick to them and ideally run those check-ins in a way that digs for and uncovers those things that aren't quite working well. And this can also present, again, if you're working offshore, a big culture mismatch, right? I mean, some cultures around the world are very hesitant to share bad news early, right? And they'll think, okay, we'll solve that. They don't need to know about it yet. So you've really got to dig for those items, especially when you can't be in the same room and you can't be face-to-face. You can't embed someone who's at a cubicle with the team and can therefore overhear the discussion that's going on. And so you really have to drive to enforce that. And I think you also have to just leverage the heck out of things like Slack or similar, you know, Teams, whatever your preferred real-time communication is. And then the thing that I would love advice on is how do you solve the problem of the whiteboard? You know, there's some excellent apps out there. There's Miro, there's some others. To me, none of them quite capture that essence of standing at the whiteboard and sketching things out. I've actually taken to taking my computer and pointing it at the whiteboard as I whiteboard, because there's, you know, it's the same thing when you think about, you know, writing on a tablet versus writing on a sheet of paper. There's something tactile and different and special that I think unlocks that creativity. I don't think we've solved that with virtual whiteboards either, but that's another area of how do you get that opportunity for brainstorming and that free flow of ideas? Because when you do that digging, when you have those check-ins and you do uncover something that looks like a challenge, then you need to solve that together. And again, how do you kind of get to the whiteboard to do that? I think is a challenge. And again, if anyone has ideas, I love them. That's one that I personally haven't solved yet, but that's something that we are working on internally. But there's really just at the end of the day, it's communicate, communicate, communicate. And when you think you've communicated enough, we'll do it again, because I guarantee you, you're still not quite on the same page as much as you would be if you were embedding resources or meeting face-to-face.
And that's probably a message that people listening should take away across the whole security space, yeah. Right? Everything that we do, we need to communicate better. We need to communicate longer, harder, call it whichever way you like. We simply can't take anything for granted, whether we're in the midst of a pandemic or coming out the other side. Mark, it's been fascinating talking to you. Some great insights there into the landscape, into people, into some of the processes we've talked about. Thank you so much for taking the time. I'm sure our listeners will take away some of those tips that you've outlined there. And it's been great talking to you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Steve. I really enjoyed it. It was a pleasure.
Thanks to this week's guest, Mark Rawls. Next week, Steve speaks about security in the mergers and acquisitions process. He'll be with Carl Allen, a private equity investor and co-founder of Prox Capital Group and the Dealmaker Wealth Society. Here's a preview.
So clearly, when you're doing a deal, depending on how big or complex the deal is, ultimately, you would go through a process of due diligence. And ultimately, as the buyer, you need to satisfy yourself that what you're buying is what you think it is. So there's a ton of legal, financial, taxation, and other documentation that you need to have. And what amazes me, what blows my mind even these days, is how much of that stuff is shared through apps like Dropbox and Google Drive. It's crazy. And if you're a small business owner and you go to a business broker and you have the broker list your business for sale, you know, out of every 100 people that look at it, 90 or so of those businesses, you know, they're not interested in buying your company. They just want to get access to all the confidential information, because then they can potentially hurt you in the marketplace. So for me, we're way behind as an industry, the M&A industry, in terms of confidentiality and the security of information. It's a major, major problem.
We'll be back for the full conversation in a week. In the meantime, is there a topic or question that you'd like us to cover in a future episode? Let us know at securityforum.org, which is also where you can find that catalog of past video and podcast episodes, as well as ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like today's. Follow us on LinkedIn by searching CEO Steve Durbin or Security Forum. Follow our audio feed wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. And if you like the ISF podcast, we'd love it if you'd write us a short review and if you'd rate the podcast. The ISF podcast is produced by TalkBox and Tavia Gilbert, with music by Alexander Filipiak, associate producer Katie Flood, mix and master by Brian Barney. Thanks for listening.